Blog Talk Radio.
Here we are. This week, new unemployment claims are down again, and the president announces that no one's killing Granny. Also, manufacturing in the United States is increasing at the fastest pace since 2004. Obama sure must be lucky. The Family Research Council has called for a boycott of the Republican National Committee. Nissan, Toyota, Hyundai, Honda have all increased their sales, and so have those. So, and the sales have also increased for GM. GM. Of course, that's as compared to last year, but an increase is an increase. Also in the news, 14 states are suing over the mandate for everyone to buy health insurance, arguing it's unconstitutional. Show me the article. The Vatican accuses the press of trying to smear the Pope on the subject of sexual abuse. Maybe they should have chosen a better word. German automaker Daimler is to pay $185 million in fines for paying bribes overseas to secure business. They haven't been convicted of making bribes or paying bribes in the United States. Here, they're called campaign contributions. Mr. and Mrs. America and all the ships at sea, welcome to Speaking of Everything with Jeff Bushman. That would be me. All that, news of the weird, and our guest, Michael Cogdell, who is a television news anchor and novelist whose new book, She Rain, came out yesterday. But first, if you have a website and aren't blogging, you're missing the best thing you can do to drive eyeballs to your website and chase dollars to your bottom line. You can do it yourself for free. Or you can have a professional writer do your blogging for you for under $100 a month. Go to jeffonblogging.blogspot.com and read all about it. Again, that's jeffonblogging.blogspot.com. And now we return to the news stories. But before we do, I wanted to mention our phone number in case you'd like to call in and talk about any subjects we have covered so far in the news headlines. Talking about what the subjects we're going to be talking about with Michael when he joins us, which include his book, of course, and news and publishing and who knows what else, but we'll see how that all goes. As I mentioned, we have news of the weird a little later. We'll go over some of that, but let me go ahead with that phone number, which is area code 347-994-3796. And if you heard our show last week, you'll understand the next comment. Everyone's invited to call unless the name you choose to use starts with the word boogie. Let's talk about some of those news stories. The unemployment claims, new unemployment claims. Unemployment, of course, is still at a high rate. Although the numbers are going to be announced tomorrow, the new jobless claims are down week after week after week. The presidential announcement that no one's killing Granny has to do with the fact that the concerns were expressed about the death panels and all of that when the health bill passed, and his point was is that no disasters have befallen America since that occurred. And by the way, there are no death panels, in case you want to check. Also, there was some correspondence I received during the last couple of weeks. I was being told by a friend of mine that someone had a Facebook page that said, let's try to get a million people together. Let's see if we can find a million people who are opposed to the health care legislation that just passed. The fact is that there are 320 million people in America. And if you can only get a million people to agree that they're opposed to the legislation, then that bodes very well for the Democrats in the midterm election. The truth is that assuming there are about 160 million potential voters, you've got to have somewhere between 60 and 80 million people who are against the legislation. I'm not saying that from the standpoint of saying that more people are opposed to it than in favor of it. I'm merely suggesting that the country is fairly evenly divided. We mentioned that the manufacturing growth in this country has increased at the fastest pace since 2004, and I made the comment that Obama must be lucky. What I really mean is that he won't get any credit for this from anyone on the quote-unquote other side of the spectrum. They all said that the stimulus funds, not all of which have been spent yet, by the way, that the stimulus funds would have no real effect on the economy because most of the jobs that the stimulus was creating were government jobs, and after all, those aren't real jobs. That's all true unless you happen to pay any attention to the branch of learning that's called economics. If you look at that, you'll understand why it is that money in the economy will, in fact, stimulate growth. That's why they call it a stimulus. Okay. And when you have more money in the economy, you increase demand, and therefore you increase purchases, and therefore you increase manufacturing and everything else. And even decrease unemployment, which is going to happen, though it's going to take a while. So manufacturing is increasing. That's what it's supposed to do as a result of the stimulus. The stimulus, folks, I'm sorry if you don't like this fact, the stimulus has been a success. We're not done yet. We haven't seen all of it, but it has been a success already. The more interesting story is that the Family Research Council, which is a conservative group, actually calling them a conservative group is like calling pre-1990 Albania a slightly leftist organization. But in any event, the Family Research Council has called for a boycott of the Republican National Committee. Now, the Republican National Committee is the organization that's now headed by Michael Steele, and this is the primary organization of Republicans in the country. The reason the Family Research Council, which normally you would assume would tend to favor Republicans, has come out this way is because the RNC recently paid $2,000 for one evening of entertainment at a club in West Hollywood. They did this to reward some of their younger donors at a club in West Hollywood, where West Hollywood is a section, is actually a city right next to Los Angeles. And at this club, supposedly simulated sex was offered. At least that's the allegation. There are two things that are really peculiar about this story. One is that the Republicans have young donors. That was the first surprise. The second surprise is that someone actually would go to West Hollywood and only get simulated sex. You know, that's. But who knows? In any event, that's what the story is. The Family Research Council is suggesting to other organizations that the Republican National Committee be boycotted. Okay. We talked about car sales increasing. Granted, that's coming off of a very low base. But an increase is an increase. The low base is last year's sales. And, of course, as you know, not only was the economy in the tank, but so were auto sales. One might say, well, since auto sales were in the tank, then, of course, the economy is going to be, and that's true. But sales are increasing. When sales increase, all kinds of good things happen, including more people employed by the car manufacturers. But all of those companies, Nissan, Toyota, Hyundai, Honda, GM, also Ford, by the way, have increased their sales over last year. And if you don't think this is related to the stimulus, that's your right, of course, but there is something to be said for the fact that nothing was working before. We talked briefly about it only in the headlines last week about states suing the federal government with the argument that to require individuals to purchase health insurance is unconstitutional. Now, an argument could be made that it's not fair, it's not right, it's inappropriate. I don't agree with that argument, but a reasonable argument could be made that that's inappropriate to require someone to buy something that they don't want to buy outside of other areas. For example, in the states, each state can and does require that if you wish to drive, you must have automobile insurance. And almost every state, probably every state now, requires you to have at least liability insurance for when you drive, so that if you run into somebody, there'll be pockets that will pay for their damages. I recognize that that's a specious argument on one level, because you're paying for the privilege to drive your vehicle within the state. If you want to drive your vehicle, then one of the conditions is, of course, it has to be registered, and in order to be registered, you have to have that insurance. In fact, the health insurance, you don't have anything else involved. You have a situation where the only thing you have to do to be required to buy health insurance is breathe. And I'm all for, by the way, I'm all for the rule that we could impose that says if you don't have to buy health insurance if you wish to stop breathing. But since that's not currently part of directly of the legislation, you're going to have to buy health insurance. And if your income, the way it's structured is, if your income is under $88,000 and you claim to not be able to afford health insurance, the government will subsidize your purchase. That's in the legislation that was passed. But the argument is that it's unconstitutional to require you to buy health insurance. We had a debate here in the state from which we are broadcasting, Arizona, on this subject. The state attorney general, who is a Democrat, did not want to join in the lawsuit that several states have undertaken with that argument. The governor requested of the legislature, both of which are Republicans, that she be given authority, which would normally vest in the attorney general, to bring the lawsuit, and they gave it to her. And in the state legislature, the vote was strictly along party lines. All the Democrats voted against giving that authorization. All the Republicans voted in favor of it. And the reason that the Democrats gave to not do it is that essentially it has no chance of success, and the state, which is having budget problems similar to but not as bad as those of California, can't afford it. Outside the issue of can't afford it, the truth is, I cannot see, and if you can, of course, you're welcome to call in to 347-994-3796. But here's the challenge that I mentioned at the beginning. Show me the article of the Constitution of the United States that would be allow you to make an argument that says that having that requirement imposed on American citizens is contrary to the Constitution. Show me the article. Tell me the article. What article is it of the Constitution, or which part of the Bill of Rights? Tell me where it says, and tell me what it says, that would in any way suggest that that would be unconstitutional. We fully recognize that not everything in the Constitution is quite that specific. There is clearly nothing in the Constitution that says, yes, you can be required to buy health insurance, or no, you cannot be required to buy health insurance. But there's not anything, in my view, that even vaguely resembles a basis for an argument that says that can't be done. If you think I'm wrong, let us know at 347-994-3796. The Vatican is involved in a sex scandal of sorts, not that they're doing anything now that we know of, but the Pope, Pope Benedict the 16th, who if I thought he listened to the show, I would apologize to, because last week I made the mistake of calling him Pope Benedictine, which I'm apparently naming him after an alcoholic drink, but I think Benedictine is an alcoholic drink, right? Yes, I'm getting assurance from our assistant producer who used to serve drinks. But in any event, it shows you how much I know about alcohol. But it's Pope Benedict the 16th. And he initially, not he, but the Vatican, presumably speaking on his behalf, was asserting that the press was smearing him by their reporting. And today they just said that the New York Times, which has been reporting on the story, has not been fair and balanced. They didn't use those words, but that's the suggestion. And the crisis about which everyone is talking relates to the fact that when Pope Benedict was a cardinal serving in Germany, he, in some fashion, helped to cover up the sexual peccadilloes, a word I love. And no one ever talks, by the way, about any other kind of peccadilloes, so for what it's worth. The sexual peccadilloes of a Father Murphy here in the United States. And though there is denial of that occurrence, that is of the cover-up, not of the sexual transgressions with deaf boys, then cardinal is accused, at least, of that, and now there is a lot of reporting on what he did or did not do, and the Vatican is crying foul which seems strange because as far as I know, there were no chickens or turkeys involved, but that's what they're doing. I think what they're really complaining about is a free press. The news of the weird that we want to report on before our guest joins us in about 9 minutes, will follow. But first, I wanted to remind you that if you are someone who is looking for a way to make money in the real estate market, sort of, without investing a lot of money or taking on huge loan obligations, you may want to think about mobile homes. And if you are thinking about mobile homes, let me offer you the website, mobilemillionaire.blogspot.com. It's the website on which you can see an excerpt from the book Mobile Millionaire, which I wrote. And at that site, you can not only read the excerpt, but you can, if you wish to, actually order and buy the book. That's mobilemillionaire.blogspot.com. News of the Weird is available on a website called newsoftheweird.com, and it is from there that we took these stories. I commend the website to you. It's quite good, and they have stories there that we can't report on here, and they have some amusing video as well. There was a video of a commercial for a computer with a webcam. Very funny, if you have a chance to see that. It's apparently on YouTube as well. Extremely funny, and not for children. But speaking of news we can report on, Joan Higgins, aged 66, is a pet shop owner in northern England. She's been fined, given a curfew, and has been required to wear an electronic bracelet. So that the court or the police know where she is at all times. Her crime? She sold a goldfish to a 14-year-old. Apparently in that area, it's illegal to sell pets to anyone under the age of 16, presumably because they are incapable of taking care of the animals at that young an age. Okay. Florida. A friend of mine presumably is listening to the show, although I expect that he is listening in archive edition. By the way, if that includes you, I should tell you we are on live on Thursday nights from 10:30 to 11:30 Eastern Time, 7:30 to 8:30 Pacific. So if you're listening in archive edition and would like to hear the next episode, that's when you can do it. And same website, and you can listen live. In any event, Florida is running huge budget deficits, but in a move to assist yacht buyers, they have proposed that the state's 6% sales tax be capped at $18,000, which would be the amount of tax you would pay on a yacht that cost you $300,000. Now, it is being suggested by its sponsors not as a gift or a tax break to the wealthy, but as something that will ease unemployment in the yacht building industry, because we all know that that's been hurt by the recession, and we have to help them. Finally, in news of the weird, insurance companies are our friends. And it's, there's been a lot of discussion recently about health insurance companies and how they treat people. And I will share or reshare a story that a friend told me, a different friend from the one I mentioned a moment ago. Well, I'll come back to that in just a second. But here's another insurance story. Mr. Houston Tracy, who has insurance, has a major medical disorder, but Blue Cross Blue Shield of Texas says it won't cover it because it was a pre-existing condition. Obviously, they couldn't do this now, but this is before the legislation. Now, what really makes it interesting is that Houston Tracy is 2 weeks old. The only pre-existing situation is that the illness was spotted prenatally while he was still in the womb. Ah, Blue Cross Blue Shield of Texas, I think you may get a couple of letters. A friend of mine had developed this non-cancerous tumor in his chest, in his breast. what it was. Apparently, I can't remember what it's called, but apparently this situation does occur where men get these what amount to fatty deposit tumors. And he wanted to go ahead and have the minor surgery that it takes to get this removed. And his insurance company initially, they later paid for it, of course, they initially denied the claim because they said they wouldn't pay for cosmetic surgery. So it's a wonderful life. This, by the way, all kidding aside, the thing that I just mentioned with regard to the pre-existing condition, which is now not going to be a problem, and the cosmetic surgery exclusion and all the rest of it, it really is a clear situation. What we really need is single-payer health insurance. And there is a bill now before the Congress, it's in the House, that would actually move us toward that. It wouldn't get us all the way there, but it would move us toward that. And let me urge you to look it up on Google. It's a bill being sponsored by Congressman Alan Grayson. And he's a Democrat. He's the guy who said that the Republicans have a very simple policy when it comes to health insurance. They want you to die. That may have been a little over the top, but it was amusing. And Grayson has sponsored this bill, has offered this bill, I should say, and it's now got, I think he said, 80 co-sponsors. And the bill is called Medicare for All. And what it would do if passed is it would allow anyone who can afford to and wants to buy into Medicare. You don't have to be 65. You can be you can be 2 weeks old like that kid if you have the money. But, or you can be 6 months old or 10 years old or in your 40s or your 50s or your 30s. It doesn't matter. You want to buy into Medicare, you buy into Medicare. Now, there's a good argument to be made that Medicare is not fiscally sound, but that can be fixed. And one of the ways it would be fixed, in part, is if we could all buy into it, the premiums for us would be greater than it would be for the folks over 65, obviously. And that would help stabilize Medicare. But the system's in place. It's a single-payer system. They're not the kind of denials that we've just been talking about. And that would move us towards single-payer, which is a good thing, in my opinion. And if it's a bad thing, in your opinion, don't buy it. Just don't buy it. Perfectly fine. Anyway, that's the situation. So if you can look that up, let me urge you, please, to find that bill. I don't have the bill number before me. And then write an email, write an actual physical letter, call. Try to get your representative in the House of Representatives to sponsor the bill. This gives me an opportunity, by the way, to handle one of my pet peeves, the mislabeling of the House of Representatives. Congress consists, this is not intended to be a civics lesson. If it's a lesson at all, it's English or English usage. Congress, the Congress of the United States, consists of two houses, the House of Representatives and the Senate. Very often, for reasons I can't even begin to contemplate, people talk about the Senate and the Congress when they mean the Senate and the House. Don't know how that developed, but if you want to refer to the House of Representatives, there's a very simple way to do it. It's the House, and the other place is the Senate. Members of the House run every 2 years, members of the Senate every six, blah, blah, blah. But there is a difference. But altogether, it's the Congress, unless you're in India, which means there's a wholly different set of meanings. We will shortly, if everything comes to pass the way it should, be joined by our guest. In the interim, I wanted to also tell you that we've got a series of guests coming up in the next several weeks. Next week, we will be having a return of Larry Hancock. And if you've been listening to the show previously, you know that he's written and spoken to us. Well, he's written books, and he's spoken to us about some assassinations of American leaders. We've spoken previously about the JFK assassination conspiracy, and that which caused the death of Martin Luther King Jr. And next week, we're going to be talking about Robert Kennedy's death. And I told the story to Larry. I will mention it to you in the moments we have remaining before Michael joins us tonight, that I was actually supposed to go to the Ambassador Hotel on the night of June 4th, 1968, and didn't. Because, in general terms, I thought I would be crowding the people in a specific car. And it wasn't just because I was overweight, but I ended up not going to the Ambassador. I was supposed to be there that evening. And I'm not sure how I feel about not having been there, to tell the truth. But anyway, we'll discuss that and other matters related to the Robert Kennedy assassination and the cover-up surrounding it next week. But this week we have, this week we have Michael Cogdell. The whoops was because I almost disconnected him while I'm trying to connect him. In fact, I did hang up. I am sorry. Let me try that again. No, he's gone, I'm afraid. I unfortunately disconnected him. Hopefully he'll call back in. You know, it's really good to be a big-time radio show host and have all this technology at your disposal so that you can really mess it up. A couple of months ago, we had a situation where our internet connection kept going down while the show was on, and it was during that session that we ended up doing the show for about 30 minutes and then calling it quits because we couldn't connect back up. Hopefully Michael will be joining us again in another second. I'm sure that was him trying to join us, and I messed up the switchboard. So hopefully he'll join us again in a second. Anyway, next week, as I was saying, is going to be Larry Hancock, and then we have scheduled a couple of novelists in a row, and then the author of a book on a children's book, actually, about something having to do with Christmas, which we'll share as we get closer, not to Christmas, of course, but to that date, which is April 29th. So that's the current schedule. Let's see what else I wanted to tell you here. We were talking about... I believe he's there now. Okay, now we'll watch when I don't try to fill in. Are you there, Michael?
I don't know what happened there. I suddenly got someone on the line who said, told me I practically won the lottery. I don't know what it was. How are you?
I'm fine, sir. How are you?
I'm better than I deserve, my dear friend, and I'm so honored to share this time with you and your listeners. Great to hear your voice.
Well, thank you. It's good to hear yours. And the answer to your question about what happened is that I messed up and I unfortunately disconnected you.
That's
so
all
that's
right.
What happened.
I've been disconnected most of my life. So here's to good connections, my friend.
Okay, that's right, indeed. Well, let me introduce you properly. Michael Cogdell is an Emmy Award winner 24 times, is a newscaster and a television news anchor. He's an author. He has interviewed the Reverend Billy Graham, Dr. Oz, Dr. Mehmet Oz, Dr. Henry Kissinger, Abby Hoffman, Hillary Clinton, John McCain, Howard K. Smith. Howard K. Smith, that one goes back a ways.
That's way back there. Yeah, that's one of the guys I grew up on in television news. And he was the first interview I ever did. I was scared out of my mind. Yeah.
I was going to say, it would have to have been when you were 12 years old that you... 12 years old when you interviewed him, probably.
Just a wee chip of a lad, yeah. I was actually an intern at a TV station, WLOS-TV, and I was about 21, yeah. He
okay,
was so very
there you
kind
go.
To me, because I was just a green beanpole of a guy with a lot of country music hair. Yeah, he was very, very sweet man, yeah.
Okay, and Michael has also won the National Edward R. Murrow Award, so he comes to us with some backing, and his new book, She Rain, was just released yesterday. I have a coincidence.
As a matter of fact, yes, it was.
Very good. I have a weird coincidence to share with you.
Play it on me.
Well, you know how sometimes you read through things pretty quickly and you think you get it, and then something you read it again and something just hits you in the middle of the forehead.
Yeah, my professional life especially, yeah.
Yeah, well, hopefully you're not getting hit in the middle of the forehead when you're going on air with a story, but what happened is that I realized in going through your biography that you were born in Asheville, North Carolina. And last week, I'm guessing you may know the name, last week my guest was Cecil Bothwell. Do you know the name?
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. And who is a city council member in Asheville, North Carolina now. So that's a very weird coincidence. Obviously, I didn't plan that.
Yep, I cover that part of the world. I grew up there, and now that wonderful part of the Appalachian Mountains, beautiful place that it is, gets to be a part of my professional life, and it's just a great, great honor. It really is, Jeff, because it's such a beautiful part of the world.
Yes, I'm sure it is. I've never been over there. But let me ask you, first off, what it is besides the book, which we'll get to in a moment. You are you're currently working as a news anchor, is that correct?
I am. I work for WYFF-TV in the upstate of South Carolina. We cover, we're a strange hyphenated market. Our market literally touches Atlanta, Knoxville, Columbia, South Carolina, Charlotte, North Carolina. We cover the Western Carolinas and Northeast Georgia. And it's the market.
Wow.
34 in the country, and we have a great family there. My co-anchors, my colleagues there are very much like family to my wife and to me. It's a wonderful place to be.
That's great. And you have now published your book, She Rain, which is a novel, and it's a novel of the South, and talks about some things that either happened, well, both you happened and you imagined as a novelist, mm-hmm. in the earlier part of the most recent century. So why don't you tell us a little bit about what the novel is?
Well, it seeded off my first memory as a child, Jeff, watching my father deliver a sadistic beating to my mom when I was 3.5 years old, and I remember it very vividly and in complete color to this day. Not only that awful event, but my mother scooping me up and taking me into a bedroom when she got him off of her, and the comfort she gave me at that time. My dad was one of seven children born into the sharp jaws of some of the most crunching poverty anyone in America will ever know. He literally had to quit school in the fourth grade to go to work to have something to eat. And that kind of privation will cause a boy to grow into a man who is longing for respect and who will often fail to respect himself. And that was my dad. And he became an alcoholic and really two men in one. He was this bifurcation of humanity. When my father was sober, there was no more brilliant emotionally and intellectually and sweet and gentle a man on earth. But alcohol did something seismic to him. It just rattled him to pieces. It rattled him into a totally different man. And to sort of jump ahead, my father died 5 years ago as a completely loved and utterly sober and utterly forgiven man. Mm-hmm. I got to whisper that forgiveness into his ear. And it's one of the great grace moments of my life, is being able to do that and let him know that everything was forgiven and all was well. And when you deal with that the evolution of a man and the harshness of the childhood that he inflicted upon me, it was a catharsis to begin to write some of it down. And that's what got me started. And mm-hmm. from that seed of reality grew this imagined tale, this story. And really it grew on the soil conditions of the strong women who raised me, Jeff. This book is a sure. is an homage to them, to my mom, my grandmother, Dovey Ella Crow in Western North Carolina, a neighbor of mine who was like a mother to me, Julia Fitchett Cook, God rest her soul, an attorney there, and just a great and mighty heavenly hellraiser of a woman who helped to give form to me, to my wife, who gave form to the two women who formed the love triangle in She Rain. And if people ask me, how in the world did you get from writing about your dad and his evolution to two women in love with the same man, and this love triangle that rises into a constellation of hope rather than descending into, you know, all hell breaks loose, which is where so many of them go. Mm-hmm. And I say, it's my wife. I fell in love with her in 1985. And then I fell in love with her anew as she grew, as she matured, as she mm-hmm. evolved into the beautiful lady she is now. And she inspired Mary Elizabeth, and she inspired Sophia in the narrative. And it is an awfully blessed man who gets to fall in love with two women in the body, mind, and soul of one. And I am that man.
That's great. How long have you been together since 1985?
We have. I married her so fast, I nearly killed her father, and he nearly killed me. I met her in February and married her on July 13th, 1985. So we're in our 25th year coming up here, our anniversary, and we're looking forward to it. And I'm going to take her to Cancun and celebrate her. That's what we're going to do.
Is there some noise in your background there?
Well, because She Rain does not happen apart from her. She was my muse and my inspiration and such a wonderful, caring, brutal at times editor, brutal when she needed to be, and it doesn't happen without her. Absolutely not.
I understand. The first question I was going to ask you is what made you decide to do a novel as contrasted with writing a history or a family history or making it a nonfiction book?
Because a novel broadens the scope of character. All fiction is born of some reality. It's like Pat Conroy says, lean into weirdos and your fiction becomes really good. And and I'm really good at that. I'm really good at sort of imagining eccentrics. And that's what I did in She Rain, because they're the people who are truly interesting in our lives, if you think about it.
Sure.
You can be too normal. And if you read Conroy, you see some of what he's talking about on the page. And what I wanted to do is imagine in sort of that same vein, down that same avenue, but in an original way, what might have happened. Sort of create, sort of once upon a time, what might have been if this kind of person
right.
encounters that kind of person, and then you set them loose on the world. And that's the fun of fiction writing. Is you just let your imagination run amok through the weeds.
Yeah.
Through the weeds
That's
of your
right.
life. Yeah.
And you become immersed in the process of writing in the story that you're creating.
It is true. It is true. And I have to say, I love everybody in that book, but especially the women. I really do. My wife fully understands and embraces it. I'm carrying on a love affair with the women in that book. And I think that's what makes it truly personal, truly intimate to a reader. And, people
sure.
have asked me, what do you think about these reviews coming back? And I said, they're not really reviews of me. They're reviews of Mary Elizabeth and Sophia
mm-hmm.
and Frankie and Rev Lou and Sarah Rose, his wife, and so many of the figures in this book who are as real to me as if they're drawing breath in the room I'm in right now. They really are.
I understand. Yeah, they do. When you're writing characters, they come out and they're part of your life, and you'll never get away from them, even if you want to, and you don't want
Ideally,
to.
Ideally, yeah, it's the way it should go. You're right. You're exactly right.
Yeah. How much of a part does the region play in the book in your mind? How important? I phrase that badly. What I really mean to ask you is, how important is the region in the book, as you see it?
The region, the sense of place, first of all, gives you a palette on which to do what I like to try to do, and it's in the reader's eye to determine whether I succeed. But I always want to write for beauty, and when you write of Western North Carolina, beauty is everywhere, and it's a harsh kind of beauty very often. It's a very hard, gnarled landscape whose vistas are soft, and even in the cold, they're somehow warm, and they're just lush with beauty. And I was really inspired along the way by what the great Charles Frazier did with Cold Mountain. He really, in my opinion, reinvented fiction, lyrical fiction. I think the man is the sort of second coming incarnation of Scott Fitzgerald. In an Appalachian-born man. And Scott Fitzgerald actually spent a lot of time in Asheville. His wife died in a mental hospital.
Was that right?
In Asheville.
Well, I knew that latter fact, but I did not know that that was there.
Yeah, he spent a lot of time at the Grove Park Inn while she was institutionalized there. And you'll notice in She Rain, Zelda Fitzgerald is the opening quote. And that is an homage to her and to Scott Fitzgerald, who is one of my great heroes. And it's funny, I was doing a newspaper interview earlier today, and the reporter said to me, and she has not read all the way through the book, she said, "What I've read so far reminds me of Jane Eyre." And I said, "Well, that's a very high compliment. I hope I one day can live up to the great Charlotte Bronte." But I said, "It's ironic that you say that, because Jane Eyre is mentioned in the book." and Charlotte Bronte and Jane Eyre, I suppose it's ironic, like give birth anew to a man. They help a man rise to meet the beautiful women around him, the great strong women around him. So it's that's one of the highest compliments I've been paid.
Yeah, there is a relationship. I'm not familiar with Cold Mountain, but I am familiar with some of the other books that yours has been compared to, The Color Purple and To Kill a Mockingbird.
Mm-hmm.
And the question also becomes, you know, how important in the telling of the story is race in the South in the early 20th century?
It is extremely
important. The question may answer itself, but go ahead.
Oh, yeah, and you know, to be compared to the great Harper Lee in To Kill a Mockingbird, which is is one of the great social tomes, not to mention great works of entertainment of our time. It may be the greatest work of American literature ever, and a book far ahead of its time. And what I wanted to do in She Rain, and devoted myself to it, is to write people far ahead of their time. In the early 20th century, racism, bigotry was an everyday run-amok tragedy of life. And that tragedy, by the way, is still too much with us today. And it's one of the reasons I wrote it into She Rain, to continue to pull us up toward Dr. King's dream. And, you know, Martin Luther King loved to talk about using the weapon of love. And She Rain is a love story at its heart. Not just a love triangle. It's not just a story of longing. It is a story of love. And what you have in She Rain is Sophia, this tall, elegant, brilliantly educated, way ahead of her time, African-American lady who has managed to fall headlong into one of the great fortunes in American life at the time, Newport, Rhode Island kind of money. But more importantly, she's fallen into this bottomless well of love, wherein no one drowns. You go in there to live. You go in there to drink it all down. And that love comes from the mother who adopted her with a Vassar education and a great gift for the piano. And she gives all of that to this African-American child, secreted away in the hills of western North Carolina. Hardly anybody knows she's there. And I thought, what might have happened? If, first of all, you set her loose on the world with that great education, with all of the benefits of that mother, especially the love, which goes viral in her, goes viral in all of us, that kind of love.
Right.
You set her loose on the world, and then intersect her life, as you do, with, I like to call him a little old lint-head boy from the middle of nowhere and the lowest expectations. And he's a white kid. And she's a black kid, and doggone it, they fall in love. I hope this isn't spoiling the story for some people.
No, I'm sure it's not. But and the problem has to do with place and time, obviously.
Yes, it does. Place and time and states of heart and mind. And I wanted to write a story that revealed the beautiful artwork of changing souls. When you see a young man, a young heart changed for the better, when you see bigotry shedded, when you see it just jettisoned like a horrible suit of armor, then you start to see what's humanly possible, and it really illustrates the greatness of our possibilities, Jeff. That's what I want people to come away from with She Rain, is there is an extravagant form of love in all of us. And so often it lives locked away, locked up in fear, locked in cages of fear. And what I want She Rain to do is get people to break those chains and let it run, let it out, let it run all over the place. Watch it improve your life.
Let me ask you about the process. I understand you've been working on this book for a very long time.
10 years. And my brother, there's a lot of 4:30 in the morning in She Rain, I'll tell you. I would come home from working at a TV station. I anchor the late news, which means I'm on the air from 11 to 11:35, having done the 6 o'clock news early in the day. And I don't have to tell you or your listeners that the news is not a pretty place. so much of the time. And we go looking for hope stories, but it seems like the darkness always tries to outshine the light. It doesn't succeed, in my opinion, but it does become hard to live with. As I would come home and retreat into the world of She-Rain, it became my antidote. It became my tonic.
Refuge.
Yeah, my refuge. Excellent word. Perfect. Against the realities of the news. And I want it to be, for so many people, so many readers, a counterpoint against the hopelessness that seems to run all over the place. And my God, it's all over our politics now. It's just so fraught with division and this sense of gloom, this sense of despair. And
sure.
I firmly believe there is a greatness within all of us that, if let out, will trample that, will trample the dark
void. Let me bring you back to the process. So you would be spending nights and early mornings writing She-Rain, and it took, if I understand correctly, about 10 years, about a decade?
About a decade of snatching time whenever I could. I spent quite a bit of time on it on vacations, Jeff. I'd go to to Hilton Head Island, go to the Caribbean. There's something about hot weather and Michael Cogdill that just makes some sweet kind of love. I love to get out and run when it's 95 degrees and 80% humidity. I am that insane, rare
I'm the same guy
who digs it.
Yeah.
And
yeah, I do
that.
I'm not as crazy about the humidity, but in terms of hot weather and running, I'm perfectly fine with it.
Most people aren't. Most people find it suffocating, and I find it liberating. And I love to sit. In fact, I wrote the epilogue sitting on a veranda at Excellence Resort in Cancun, Mexico, looking out at the Western Caribbean. And the book does end on the coast, which made it very helpful. And
So what you're really telling all of us is that you wrote that trip off.
Yeah, not yet. You know, I haven't done that, but that's an idea. Yeah.
There you go. It's research.
Yeah, exactly. Right.
And in terms of your duties at your TV station, I assume that you weren't during those 10 years, you were not a field reporter, so you were able to do the anchoring and then go home and write.
Yeah, well, I started out at WIFF as a weekend anchor and field reporter, and I've always kept a devotion to field reporting. But when I became a main anchor, oh, my God, how long has it been? Oh, 12 years ago or so.
Mm-hmm.
It gave me the night shift, first of all. And that really, it sounds like hell, but it's really a heaven for me because it freed up some time, especially in the wee hours.
Sure.
You know, it gets really nice and quiet after about midnight. Eastern time. Midnight, any time zone.
Wherever you are, yeah.
Yeah, it's wonderful. And if you have a schedule that enables you to be up in that in sort of that gentle, you know, velvety quiet, it's very useful for a writer, and it helped me tremendously. I'm a rare guy that I can write on an airplane and you know, whatever, and I'm always getting ideas, and you scribble them down on pieces of paper. It's like if you go to Carl Sandburg's home in Western North Carolina, Connemara, brilliant man that he was, they still have his office pretty much intact up there, and there are all these little shards of paper everywhere. And they have them as they were there because that was part of his process. He just scribbled ideas all over, and it struck me the first time I saw it, you know, that's a great way to work. Because if you don't write the idea down and let it, you know, sort of take its place among the chaos, you will forget it. Better chaos than the abyss of loss. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Right. I was going to say, that's going to be one of the features of the new iPad. Is that you'll never be away from someplace where you can write something down.
You know, that's a wonderful thing. Yeah, you sort of keep that thing under your arm. Yeah, it would certainly benefit my process. Because even with laptops and wireless technology, you know, the doggone thing is you're still a sort of a slave to its sense of place. And the iPad is different. And it's going to change publishing very radically, too. It really will.
Yeah, I'm sure you're right. And speaking of publishing, I note that your wife is in the publishing industry. Did that have anything to do with the manner in which your book was published?
It actually did not. My wife and I got into the children's publishing business sort of by inertia. I saw a young man on a on a beach on Hilton Head in a power wheelchair one day, on a day when I was sitting around on a vacation, a big, beautiful summer day, feeling sorry for myself and worried about a thousand things that don't matter. And suddenly here's this young man, and he's on this beach, and he's going as hard as he can go. He's almost in the water. There's a beautiful young lady with him, and I don't think he's taken a solitary step his entire life. And that I saw him, and I looked at my feet. You ever look at your feet?
Mm-hmm.
You ever look at your legs?
Yeah.
And you whisper into the cosmos. You whisper into the ears of God, thank you. This is an extraordinary gift, being able to stand up and take a step, and another one after that.
Sure.
There are people longing for one step and working their tails off for. And that inspired a little children's book called Crack of the Crab and the Sideways Afternoon that I started writing on a cardboard box in the garage because I couldn't get that young man out of my head. And my wife got hold of it and said, get out of my way, get behind me, Satan, step aside, Satan. I'm going to do something with this, and you're going to love it. And then the $11,000 checks start going off to Hong Kong, and I think she's lost her mind. And then the next thing you know, the books show up, and they're heirloom quality, and they're beautiful. And they're beautiful because of her, not because of me. That book is 5% me and 95% her. And it's available now on crackofthecrab.com, and no publisher has ever seen it. We own it, and we've kept it that way. She Rain is trade published. That's totally different. But that's
right.
What
and
got
let me
started.
Just let me
yeah.
Let me just make clear something you just said, because people hear things they don't necessarily know how it's spelled, and if they have to access a website, that's important. You're referring to crackofthecrab.com.
Mm-hmm.
Cracker
right.
Like a rich cracker, the
that's
crab.
It.
All on word, crackofthecrab.com. Okay, go ahead with what you were saying.
And what happened with that book is it gave us the confidence to, it gave me the confidence as a writer, first of all, to go headlong into She Rain, knowing that we can gain audience. And I want to encourage everyone, do not despair. If you get a rejection letter, if you get 25 of them, Matt Lauer got a lot of rejection letters in TV news before he got to Today Show. Pay no attention to it. Critics like the poor will always be with us, and they're not necessarily right. And very often they are wrong, and they're especially wrong if you get busy and prove them wrong. And you know, Cracker gave us that confidence. And when I see a review on She Rain now, and they're coming in from all over the country and Canada. Thanks to our publicist, which is a great group, FSB Associates out of New Jersey. I see these reviews coming in, Jeff, and they're just off the charts. I mean, women are talking about this book as a tear-raising, self-improving, entertaining read.
That's great.
I've had a woman call it a classic, best book she's ever read. When you have that, you realize that you're in hands much bigger than your own. And I'm truly thankful to the divine for it, and I want that book to become a legacy, not only of entertainment, but of meaning, especially to women, because too many women suffer a terrible sense of self-worth.
Or a lack thereof,
An absence sometimes of it. And what I want them to do is get into She Rain and say, you see, you do not have to live down to what people said about you, who they claimed you to be, whether you're 40 or when you were 4 years old. People say things they can never really take back, and those things take root in people. And people begin to live down to them and cause them to be true because of the way they live down to them. And what I want them to do is read this book and then live up to Sophia, live up to Mary Elizabeth, and watch how they helped a little old linthead boy from the middle of nowhere live up to a greatness nobody could see coming. And I'm not going to tell you what I did with him, listeners.
That would spoil the story.
Yeah, you'll be surprised.
That's right. Let me also mention a couple of other things. First off, we've got about just a little over 5 minutes left.
Yes, sir.
Also, you know about the clock because of what you do for a living.
Every night. Yeah, it's completely unforgiving.
Right. And I also wanted to mention the book is called She Rain, S-H-E-Rain. And it's available at all of the outlets like Amazon and Barnes & Noble, and it's probably, I would assume, you can tell me if I'm wrong, but I assume it's also in, actually, physically, in some a lot of the major bookstores now.
It is, and if you go into a bookstore, because, you know, the big box bookstore business is in chaos right now.
Sure it is.
Those people don't know what they're, it's not that they don't know what they're doing, they just don't know what to do. With all of the change that's going on with ebooks and everything, and you know, there's such an obsession in that business with celebrities.
Yep.
If you can write about Tiger Woods or you are Tiger Woods, you know, they'll stock it by the millions. But even some of the top writers have trouble penetrating it. So I counsel people, go in and pound the tables for She Rain at your local bookstore, but know you can always get it through Amazon.com. God bless them.
Right. And, yeah, and undoubtedly the same is true at BarnesandNoble.com and
it's true. It's
Owls
true.
And every place else online,
right.
Because if nothing else, they can order it at your request.
One of the things I love about that kind of buying
yeah.
is you get to see reviews. You get to see inside the book. You get to
right.
read what other people think. And these are
right.
people I don't know. I mean, a couple of them I do on Amazon. There happen to be readers, though, and they're independent. But most of them are reviewers
right.
from all over the country, and you get to see that, and it can guide your purchasing decisions. And I think it's wonderful to be an informed consumer on that.
Yes, absolutely. You know, you're working on another novel called The Bells of Honeysuckle Road.
I am. I've just gotten started. I'm having a blast with it. Yeah, I have worked
well,
on it.
Well, this is not going to take another 10 years, right?
God, no. I should live so long. Yeah, it cannot. As much as I enjoy the process, no, this one's going to have to
no,
go
no, 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 no. Well, typically with most writers, and I know you know this, is the first one takes a very long time.
Mm-hmm.
The second one, pardon me, isn't something that's a quick operation, but it takes much less time. If for no other reason you know much more about what you're doing, and you have an idea of where you want to go, or you wouldn't have sat down in the first place, unlike the first one where you may not have been exactly sure.
Well, you're less intimidated on the second one.
Yeah.
The blankness of the mm-hmm. page is less daunting, at least to me, and I think that's true with a lot of
right.
writers. If you found the way to the words, the end, in a satisfying way, and then you've been an editor at the same time, and so I think to have written and edited one makes you a better writer and editor for the future.
That's undoubtedly true, and not only that, now your wife is better trained as an editor of your work.
Yes, and continues to train me. Yeah, yeah. She has two pets in this house, a golden retriever named Mags and me, and she
yeah.
trains us both expertly. Yeah.
Yeah.
We're in her
yeah,
house.
Hopefully you smell better coming in out of the rain, but
not at all. No. I'm a complete redneck. Yeah, it's a. But she loves me anyway.
That's good. Real quickly, in the time we have left, because I'm sure people don't really know why, tell me why. What is She Rain? Not the book, because that's already done, but explain what the word She Rain means.
She Rain is an old mountain folklore term taught to be my grandmother. Dovey Ella Crow was her name. Isn't that a beautiful name? She's a beautiful lady.
It certainly is.
A little lady, never had a driver's license, and worked in cotton mills her entire life, and had about a third grade education, and was wise beyond so many human years. And she used to point
mm-hmm.
to the storm clouds that would ride the mountains when I was a little boy, and a little piece of that fog would break off and drift along the treetops, and it looks like lace. It looks like I describe it in the book as a tearing off a wedding gown, a great heaven wedding mm-hmm. gown. And she would say, look at the She Rain, honey. Look at that. Isn't that beautiful? And you know the thing about She Rain is it is not afraid to soar, nor is it afraid to fall. It goes where the wind takes it, and it goes with beauty, and it goes with courage, and it goes with faith. And wouldn't it be beautiful if we, humankind, could do likewise? Wouldn't that be a great beauty in this life? That's why I named it She Rain.
And that is a... That is a great note on which to end, because we've got just about a minute. The book is She Rain. It's available on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, and bookstores. And, Michael, congratulations, and thank you very much.
Jeff, I am honored by you. God's peace and sweet dreams to all. Thank you so much.
As to you. Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye for now.
And take care. And the remaining seconds we have, let me invite you to join us again next week. As we used to say, same bat time, same bat station. And I want to thank our wonderful producer, Autumn Bushman. She's lying under her blankie on her dog bed right now, and our assistant, Alicia Bushman. And with all of that, we will see you, or have at you, so to speak, next week, Thursday, from 7:30 to 8:30 Pacific, 10:30 to 11:30 Eastern. Thanks again. Have a great week, and adios.